Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first occasional lecture for 2015. And in welcoming you, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land and pay respect to all Indigenous elders, past and present. To kick off 2015 today, we'll be talking about democracy, trust and legitimacy. And I don't think you can get any more fundamental than that when it comes to looking at questions of how we operate our system of government and the sorts of values that we want to be imbued therein. Now, today's lecturer will be familiar to you all because we do not think of questions of ethics and governance without thinking in the same breath of Dr. Simon Longstaff. He is the Executive Director of the St James Ethics Centre. He has a PhD from Cambridge. He's been awarded an Order of Australia. He's a member of many international and national boards and committees of various types to do with governance and ethics and the importance of having standards of behaviour that suit a civil society, a society that we all want to inhabit. Now, can I ask you at the beginning, if you have a mobile phone with you, please switch it to silent now. I've never done this in 25 years of being associated with these lectures, but the last lecture last year, more mobile phones went off than in the entire previous 25 years. So that's my admonition to you from the beginning. At the end of the lecture, Dr. Longstaff has kindly agreed to take questions, and we have another innovation this year. Don't say things never change. This year we have roving microphones. So at the end of the lecture, if you have a question, I'd ask you to raise your hand in the air and a roving microphone will come to you rather than having to navigate the precipitous stairs in this room. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Simon Longstaff today to talk about democracy, trust and legitimacy.
Well, Dr. Lang and my fellow citizens, it's very good to be here with you today to discuss this topic. I'd like to thank the Clerk of the Senate for the invitation to join you here today and also personally to pay my respects to the Indigenous elders on whose country we meet, those past, present. Now, I want to begin by telling you a true story, one validated by the principal actor in it, the former Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam. He was in London and was invited during a visit to the United Kingdom to give a speech to the good and the great from the City of London in the Mansion House. And on this particular occasion, the host for the event was the then Lord Mayor of London. And Whitlam was thinking what he was going to say by way of a few informal remarks before launching into what I think was going to be a fairly dry speech about economic policy, but was wondering what possible connection he could make with his host, because whereas Whitlam saw himself as a radical reforming Labor Prime Minister, the then Lord Mayor of London was an arch conservative. So he was reading down a briefing sheet provided by a protocol officer, and he noticed just one thing which stood out in the career of the Lord Mayor, and that was that he was a distinguished oarsman. He'd rowed for his school, he'd rowed for his university, and he'd gone on, I think, to have rowed for Great Britain. So the Whitlam stands up, and you can imagine the scene, you know, long tables, you know, beautifully pressed and starched linen, gold and silver, people in livery, black tie, all the rest. And Whitlam says, Your Worship, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, I came here this evening thinking that His Worship and I have absolutely nothing in common. But now I find that we are united by one thing, because as you know, he is a distinguished oarsman and I am a politician. And the thing that unites us is that we both look one way and go the other. I had dinner with him once, and I asked him if this was true, and he assured me it was, and took great pride in the witticism that he'd coined. Well, this notion of looking one way and then going the other obviously has its humorous edge, but that edge is progressively being blunted when you look around our society and begin to see what flows from that general phenomenon, where individuals, where institutions look one way, go the other, say one thing, do something else. And you can see it in a whole host of institutions that seem to have had a decline in trust, whether it's corporations, and particularly those, say, in the financial sector, churches, religious organisations of one kind or another. And, of course, public institutions like parliaments, political parties, politicians. So much so now that you're beginning to see deep and public questioning about these institutions and the individuals who allegedly serve them, questioning about politics and whether it's still in any sense a noble pursuit, about parliament and associated institutions, and even about the value of democracy itself. There have been a range of commentators. Some of them, you know, are just seeking to, I think, achieve a certain degree of notoriety by their comments. Recently on 3AW, the broadcaster Tom Elliott actually suggested that it was really time for, I quote, a benign dictatorship to make tough but necessary decisions. He went on to say that the problem was that we as voters, we've developed short attention spans and high expectations, that it's something wrong with us, that there's a fault in the body politic, and this is the kind of solution. And as we'll see a little bit later, this is not just a lone voice that is questioning the place of democracy and whether it is well enough equipped to deal with the challenges we face. Slightly more thoughtful and nuanced analysis has come from the great journalist and historian of Australian politics, Paul Kelly, who's recently been asking similarly profound questions about whether or not the structure of politics, the way in which it's practiced today, is capable of addressing the challenges we face. I think his conclusion is, and it's a rather pessimistic one, much more pessimistic than I hold, is that there's something fundamentally broken that needs to be repaired, that this is a fractious polity that has fed in all sorts of ways into the practice of politics in this country, which ill serves the national interest. Now, I don't think that in this, as you'll see, there's any particular villain. I know that what we like to do is to find the person in the black hat, the single individual that can be blamed for all of this. I'm going to suggest during the course of today that maybe some people become the apotheosis of a particular trend, but we need to think much more broadly. This is not about coalition parties, any political party or any political individual. It's rather about a larger set of questions that we need to address. And one of the things that I think we need to recognise is that we can set this question about the state of our democracy at the moment in a much longer narrative, which is to do with the way in which we tend to forget things, at least to forget their central purpose. See, one of the ideas I'd like to put before you for consideration is that we are somewhere, I hope, near the end of what might be called a long age of forgetting, a long period in which institutions that were established with great moments of insight, which in a sense gave them their foundation, have been allowed to grow, to develop all sorts of magnificent elements in their exterior. And yet, meanwhile, the foundations, those insights that gave rise to them, have been forgotten, sometimes over very long periods of time. So think about an institution like the market. At its most basic form, two people meet at a ford in a river. One is hungry, one is cold, one has wool, one has wheat, and they exchange. Or think about certain institutions around the notion of justice, the idea that it just can't be right, that because somebody is merely stronger than you, they have the right to appropriate, to take from you the property that you otherwise have by right of your own labour, your own hard work. These deep insights create the foundations for which institutions are built. And yet, when you surround them with doctrine and dogma and sometimes magnificent buildings of this kind, what lies at their heart is forgotten. And therefore, when you see this long age of forgetting unfolding itself, what comes with this forgetting is an enhanced capacity, in fact, to betray the very things that these institutions were designed to achieve or the interests that they were designed to serve. Now, we see this in society from time to time, in fact, with unfortunate frequency these days, where great institutions betray the very ideals for which they were established and are immediately perceived with justification by the wider public as being engaged in hypocritical conduct. And when you experience hypocrisy, when you experience people who routinely look one way, go another, say one thing or do something else, the product of that hypocrisy is cynicism, which acts as a kind of acid that eats away at the bonds of association within a community or weakens an institution. And that's what I think we need to think about in terms of what's happening to our democracy today. And one of the antidotes to this particular problem is to go back and to ask yourself, well then, what are the fundamental purposes? What are the fundamental things we need to understand in relation to the institutions we care about and seek to see flourish? So what I'd like to do now is to do some thinking afresh. It's really an act of recollection for all of us in terms of what democracy is actually about, and why, if you understand what democracy is, it will help to explain why the public and those who are involved in political life have reason to have concern, because understanding what it is begins to give a sense of why there's such an edge to the public debate about where we are today. Now, some people think that you can define democracy by a set of particular institutional arrangements. So in this great place, with the Senate and the House of Representatives, a parliament, for many people would seem to be an archetype of what you would expect to find within any functioning democracy, surrounded by things like free and fair elections and all of the panoply of what we would expect because of our experience of representative democracy in this country. And so when we look abroad at other systems, if they have something like our institutional arrangements, we might conclude, well, they too are democratic. And if they have something different from us, then we might question the kind of legitimacy of the democratic claim when it's made. But that, of course, is not how one should understand democracy. Different political systems are not, in fact, defined by the particular institutional arrangements that they make, but rather by a deeper philosophical distinction that occurs. And I think, in my work, when I was working on democracy back at Magdalen in Cambridge, what I argued is an old picture of how to distinguish between these things, which is that the best way, in fact, to distinguish between political systems is to do where the ultimate source of authority happens to lie. So it works pretty simply. In a theocracy, the ultimate source of authority is God. In an aristocracy, traditionally, it was in the virtuous. In a plutocracy, the ultimate source of authority was with the wealthy, and so on and so on. In a kleptocracy, with those who can steal as much. You know, you can look at where this happens to be. But the interesting thing is, what we come to understand is the thing that distinguishes a democracy from other kinds of ocracies is that the ultimate source of authority lies in the persons of the governed. Or sometimes that's shortened to say, the ultimate source of authority is in the people. Now, when you understand that this is what democracy is, that it is the ultimate source of authority lies in the hands of the governed, then all sorts of things need to be thought through as a result of that. The first of those things to understand is that there are certain limitations that apply in any kind of government or system that seeks to claim the legitimacy of being democratic. And that hasn't always been a source of legitimacy. It happens to be at this point in time that people look to democracies and they often claim it's the most legitimate form of government. And to the extent that anybody wants to make that claim, they need to know that when they do so, it has to be bound by some constraints upon what they can and can't do. For example, in a democracy where the source of authority is ultimately located in the persons of the governed, then the notion of them giving consent to be governed is absolutely essential. I just noticed up in the display around the Magna Carta at the moment that one of the things they have is a little excerpt from the proclamation from Edward I in 1295, when he said that, you know, calling the Parliament together, that which touches all should be approved by all. So this idea of consent runs very deep through this notion. And of course, in order to be able to give free consent, free, prior and informed consent, which we'll come to in a moment, it's necessary that you be unconstrained in the way in which you actually come to give this. No one should be able to use any form of compulsion to shape the initial conditions from which you choose to give consent or not. So one of the problematic questions that you have when governments seek to use compulsion not to regulate your conduct, but how you might think, how you might form a view about what constitutes a good life, for example, is that this falls outside what should be licit within a democracy. And so one of the problems I was looking at when I was doing my original research was whether or not it was in fact consistent with democracy to introduce something like a compulsory national curriculum, in which a government would be able to determine what is the basic knowledge, what are the basic dispositions that all citizens should have, and compel you to come and see the world in this way to some degree. And I argued, perhaps, and some people would think unusually, that in fact it was illicit and self-defeating for a democracy to seek to impose such a thing, because what they would start to do is not merely reflect a view of a good life, but use compulsion to promote a view of the good life. You can't actually restrict access to the enabling goods that a citizen would need to draw upon in order to be a participant within the democratic polity. Again, I was on this occasion in New Zealand talking to a senior official from their cabinet office, and they had enacted laws which were effectively requiring doctors to, as a matter of conscience, for the sake of their patients, to engage in acts of conscientious objection. They were doing something, and I won't go into the details of what they were doing, which was strictly prohibited, but the kind of thing that you ought to do for your patients if you were genuinely committed to their well-being, as doctors typically are. And this cabinet official, when challenged about this, said, oh, well, actually, no, there's no problem with this. We can do whatever we like because we have a democratic mandate. We were actually elected by the people. Well, this is a nonsense. There are boundaries. There are boundaries set by our constitution that limit what you can do despite what you think might be your democratic mandate. But at an even more fundamental level, there are boundaries as to what you could legitimately do as a democracy. For example, you could not seek to have a percentage of your population in a perpetual state of ignorance, denied the opportunity of the basic good of education, which would enable them to make informed decisions. You could not legitimately deny a section of your population access to reasonable health care so that they are well enough that they, in order to be able to make meaningful choices in their lives. There are certain enabling goods which in a democracy ought to be available to you as a citizen so that you can discharge your responsibility or exercise your right to be this ultimate source of authority, which is one of the reasons when you look at the condition of Indigenous people, most recently disclosed in the latest report on progress, it's such a troubling thing. Apart from any concern you might have just at a human level or with a regard for historical justice, this is just a million miles away from what you would expect from a democratic society. And fortunately, no one that I know of in this parliament says this is a good thing. They're just as troubled as I am by the gaps still yet to be closed. You need to have a regard in a democracy to the fundamental equality of citizens in that sense, that everyone as a citizen ought to be regarded as equal, irrespective of where they live, irrespective of their age, their colour, their gender, all the other things that might be used to distinguish between people. They don't matter when it comes to the basic notion of being enrolled as a citizen. And that means that there are some people, because it's all based on this notion about the capacity to give consent, who may be judged to be too young to do that, to actually make free, prior and informed consent, which is why we do have a qualification around the voting age and the movement into the full status of citizenship. But assuming you have that capacity to make such choices, then you're equal. Now, of course, we have at the moment pockets of the population who are invisible. They are only partially seen by the political apparatus. So at the moment, the way in which politics is practiced, party politics in Australia, much of it is focused on politicians having only a partial gaze when it comes to looking at the Australian public. So you are probably seen with much greater clarity and concern if you live in a marginal electorate than if you happen to live in an electorate where nothing much seems to swing on the nature of the vote. There will be certain pockets of the population who are judged to have greater influence. either because of their wealth or their capacity to mobilise resources more generally, whatever. They may be seen with a greater degree of clarity, I'm talking here amongst the political class, than those who don't have that capacity to advance their political interests. And the partial gaze, here I'm not talking about government per se, but I'm talking about the way politics is, that you, the machinery of politics, the action of it, says you necessarily notice some people more than others because that's part of the great contest to secure power. That in itself is deeply problematic for democracy. But the other great thing, which of course we all know, the kind of the elephant in the room, if you like, is that if it is the case that the ultimate source of authority lies in the persons of the governed, and if that authority is expressed from time to time by the active expression of consent, then the quality of the consent becomes a critical question. The gold standard is free, prior, and informed consent. And it's this notion of informed consent which has been such a subject of criticism in recent elections and in the general discussion about democracy. Because it cannot be an informed consent if it is ever based on a lie, a conscious or a moderate falsehood. The only way that you can exercise informed consent in a democracy is if those who are seeking to exercise public power through the result of an election are giving a truthful account of what it is that they propose to do. That they do so without guile, without dissembling, without the kind of qualification that has since been seen in notions such as core promises and non-core promises and all the things which offend a public which knows that they are being gamed by those rhetorical devices. At the moment, as we've seen, politics has got to a point where that truth has become so central that those contending for power will actually make a virtue of their commitment to making promises, keeping promises, not making surprises and things of that kind. So that coming to power with that being part of their portfolio, they then suffer a much greater consequence when they're perceived to have looked one way, gone another, said one thing and done something else. Now, I don't think that the people who do this are consciously engaging in hypocrisy, any more than I think that bishops in churches who said, you know, treated the way in which people who were subject to child abuse woke up in the morning and said, look, today what I'd like to do before lunch is engage in a massive amount of hypocrisy in the way we're going to respond, because when I go to bed tonight I'd like to have a tide of cynicism surrounding this whole issue. That's not what happens. Hypocrisy of this order is often not so much the product of a deliberate decision, but instead it's a product of a kind of unthinking custom and practice which has become the norm. In fact, if you go into almost any situation where something pretty unpleasant has happened and you ask people what they were doing at the time, they will first of all look back and say, yes, gosh, I don't know how I happened to do this. This is terrible. I can see the effects of this. But equally, when you say, well, what were you doing? They'll say, well, everybody was doing it. That's just the way things were done around here. And in fact, today I spend my time going into all sorts of organisations where you ask people, why do you do this? And the most common response is, what do you mean? Everybody does it. That's just the way things are done around here. So the politicians, with their partial gaze, with their temptation to claim that they have a mandate, even though what they do might be at odds with democracy itself, that will make a promise which they are happy to break or to redefine in some way and pretend that it didn't happen. I'm not suggesting that this, as I say, is a deliberate thing that's happening. I think they too stand in thrall of a kind of unthinking custom and practice where if you talk to them about it, they'll say, well, that's just the way politics is. That the community understands this, that they sort of know when we say it, we don't really mean it, and we're all complicit as an electorate and as a political class in this basic failure within what democracy would expect. And those who believe that are wrong. Because the effect of this is having a very profound effect on trust in not just politics, not just political parties, but in our political institutions. Now, trust is a very interesting phenomenon. it actually pops up in the economics literature in quite an interesting way that helps give some sense of what we're wrestling with here. Because I think, as I'm going to suggest later, although we focus a lot on trust, there is a larger question that we need to address, which is far more profound, and that's to do with legitimacy. But let's just stick with the trust question at the moment. And in this, I'd like to just pay acknowledgement to Giacomo Bianchino, who helped me with some of the research around the statistics here. In economics, one of the propositions is that high trust equals low cost. And we all sort of can imagine a pretty simple example of this. If any one of us in this room now was to reach an agreement about doing something and we could do so on the basis that we can trust each other to follow through, it might just be as much or nothing more than the symbolic shaking of hands to say, yes, I've agreed to do this, and you would expect that to follow on. That doesn't cost a lot to do. A handshake and an agreement of that kind that will be honoured is almost nothing to do. On the other hand, if there's been a history of mistrust in which the agreements have been broken, what people typically do is they begin to increase the costs they're willing to bear in order to bring about the delivery of the promise or the agreement. So they might think that there needs to be an extensive contract and enforcement mechanisms and a whole panoply of different devices, the expense of which has to be borne by the system as a whole to do this. So high trust systems operate with very little cost. Low trust systems become very expensive to operate because we make allowance for the possibility that the commitments will not be honoured. Well, some of that's happening at the moment. What we see is, of course, there are very expensive mechanisms that are being put in place to try and deal with the breach of trust problem. In the state where I live, New South Wales, there's the Independent Commission Against Corruption. I think there's now a Parliamentary Ethics Commissioner or some equivalent term. There are various checks and balances that are put in place. And as recent events have shown, involving the Labor Party in New South Wales and the Liberal Party in New South Wales, its expenditure, which is warranted, because the evidence seems to suggest that the basis for trust has been eroded and the goodwill of the people have been betrayed. But this is not just having effect in terms of the kind of costs, the hard costs that have to be borne, but also there's a cost that goes in terms of the robust character of our democratic polity. Now, the Lowy Institute poll from 2014 showed that around about 24% of people think that autocracy might be a reasonable solution to dealing with the complex problems that our society faces. Remember the journalist or the broadcaster from 3AW, time for a benign dictatorship to make tough but necessary decisions. 24% people think that. More troubling is that only 42% of 18 to 29-year-olds who were surveyed in the Lowy Institute poll actually have a strong commitment to democracy. A majority do not. Now, that is telling us something which, not we're saying we should panic, it's not the end of the world, but that is a serious issue to contend with if only 42%, a minority of people, have this very strong commitment. Now, why do they lack commitment? Well, 45% of the respondents thought of the lack of distinction between the two principal political parties and their policies was one reason. And I'll come to that in a moment as to what's happening inside politics and particularly parties. 42% claimed that democracy was only serving the interest of a few rather than the many. The fundamental proposition of democracy being betrayed by the way it was actually being practiced. Other systems were believed to have a better chance of dealing with complexity. Other people just took it for granted, about 63%. When you can look at the poll yourself, either way, this decline in trust in the institution of democracy and the system itself is not just something which has happened overnight. It's been progressively declining, this level of engagement, and it should be a cause for concern. Now, one of the reasons for this being happening, I think, is that our system of public institutions are being infected by the demands and ambitions of private associations. And what are those private associations? They are political parties. Let's not forget, political parties are entirely private associations that conduct their affairs in order to contest for public power. And one of the very sad things that I've seen in New South Wales is that the activities of those private associations, in which individuals, either for their own benefit or for the benefit of their party, have engaged in conduct of a kind which is calling into question our public institutions, the standing of our parliament, our democracy, and other associated institutions. And that's a fundamental issue that we need to contend with. What do we do about the fact that private associations can have such a baleful effect upon our public institutions? Because parliaments do not belong to political parties, they do not belong to individual politicians, they belong to us, the citizens. They are ours for our benefit, and to the extent that they are degraded by these private associations, the public good, the public weal, is being eroded. And yet, political parties, they clearly can play a useful role. They have within parliamentary systems for many, many centuries, not necessarily with the same tight restrictions which are imposed here in Australia, which, if you look at the way Australian political parties operate in the parliament, they have a degree of discipline which is unknown in the rest of the parliamentary world. There's a far greater history of freedom and fluidity within political parties than you would see here with the operation of the whips. And it does vary from party to party here, but the general tendency is far more strict than is found to be useful in other places. But the other thing that's happened, of course, is that politics now has started to be more about the machine. How do you run the machinery of politics, the machinery of gaining power, rather than, as clearly as it used to be, having both a shared understanding of the purpose for which power is being sought, sometimes described as a kind of ideology that you could put forward, or what restraint ought to be applied in terms of how it's gathered. Now, in our work at the Ethics Centre, we do quite a bit of effort goes into working with the Australian Defence Force, particularly in the area of pre-deployment for soldiers, sailors and airmen who are going to be put into places like Afghanistan, Iraq and other places where they'll encounter the conditions of asymmetric warfare. One of the key elements that sort of informs what we do is a very interesting statement from the Canadian philosopher Michael Ignatieff, that the difference between a warrior and a barbarian is ethical restraint. Now, I'm not sure what the equivalent of warrior and barbarian is in the world of politics, but the notion of ethical restraint becomes essential to how you go about pursuing the pursuit and exercise of power if you're not going to destroy the democratic institutions. And if all you are thinking about is how most effectively to run the machine of politics, without the kind of ideological grounding that it makes it matter, then you get yourself into difficulties. But also, I think in the practice of politics, we've lost some of the deeper human dimensions that used to unite people in earlier decades, certainly in the time that I've been alive. Now, recently, Tom Uren died. He was, I think, a fairly left-wing character. I mean, don't think it, I know that he was. He was a man of the left. But he had been on the Tyburma Railway with Sir John Carrick, who is very much of the Liberal Party. And like others of his generation, who had been through some truly awful experiences in war, and including the tragic circumstances in which those people found themselves in places like Hellfire Pass, and the Hellfire Pass, there was something that united their practice of politics which was deeper than just the contest that went for one party against another. It was impossible for these people not to know something of the deeply human experience that made democracy matter, that made the contest of ideas vital. It doesn't mean that they weren't combative, that they weren't committed to their causes, but there was a deeper human level that informed them because of their shared experience. In fact, I had the privilege of walking through Hellfire Pass about a year ago, and as you listen to the audio that accompanies you, and it's a really incredible experience to go there, to see this land terraformed by those prisoners of wars and other people from the region who'd been enslaved to do this. You hear both voices on that tape. You hear Uren and Carrick. You think, well, you know, that was something about politics, that it had a meaning and depth greater than just the contest, just the machine. And so what we find then is that you put these things together, a decline in trust brought about by the looseness with which the basic promise of democracy that you will be able to exercise informed consent is betrayed. You see machine politics, private associations contending for power in ways that destroy trust in not just those parties but public institutions. You see a lack of something deeper and more meaningful that informs those who come into the parliament and the shared experiences that can act as a kind of ballast, that ethical restraint I talked about. And you have an observable and somewhat precipitous decline in trust. But that's not what is really, really matters, because there's something far more significant that we stand on the precipice of. And as I use words like precipice and precipitous decline, let me again say I'm talking here as an optimist rather than a pessimist, as it might seem. I think there are ways back from this. I was standing, this is a small and probably useless biographical detail, but I was standing in the shower one day listening to the radio broadcast describing unfolding events in the deserts of Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi was hiding and the last moments of his life were fast approaching. And I wondered, what was it that Gaddafi had lacked that put him hiding somewhere in the desert? I mean, he was a man who had his armed forces, he had vast reserves of wealth, stockpiles of arms, mercenaries on hand for the buying, and yet it was him who was hiding, not somebody else. What did he lack? And the thought that occurred to me was that the one thing that he lacked was legitimacy. And the thought that became clear to me as I started to play around with this idea, which I put to you, is that although one can suffer and survive a lack of trust, because we will compensate in the way I described in economic terms by increasing the mechanisms by which we get by even though we don't trust each other, what you cannot survive is a loss of legitimacy. Because the moment legitimacy is lost, no one will deal with you irrespective of the cost. The very reason for your continuing to exist and to act once that legitimacy is lost means that you can no longer continue. You must vacate the field or you will be removed. Now, I think that there is, in fact, at the moment, a challenge in terms of the legitimacy of our democratic institutions, including these private associations, the political parties, and the role of the political class, the class itself. And it is not something which can be sheeted home to any particular individual, certainly not at this particular time. There has been, over a very long time, a slowly rising tide of concern within the electorate. I think there have been plenty of things, and I mentioned the core promise, non-core promise and other things, going back Labor, Liberal, wherever you look you can find those who've, albeit a thimble at a time if you like, have been pouring some of the sludge into this tide that's been rising. The really bad luck for Tony Abbott, and it's partly bad luck and partly something of his own making, is to be there at the point when the tide was about here. And when he came in and made such a virtue of how he was going to keep his promises and how he was going to reverse the kind of ethical slide which he depicted as having occurred under the Labor Party before. And it had. I mean, it's not as if he was making all of this up. It had. It's his bad fortune that people, in a sense, grasped onto that little straw that was flowing on the tide just before he tipped in the next thimble. And he now inherits the consequence of that. He's almost a personal embodiment of that rising tide and what happens when it just goes too far. And speculation about his personal fate in terms of the prime ministership and things is beyond for me. It's a matter for political party, the Liberal Party, to decide for itself. But when people look at results in elections like Victoria and Queensland and say, oh, well, it's a volatile electorate, or they don't really understand us, or if only we'd better communicated, I think they are grossly underestimating the seriousness to the legitimacy of the political process and to political parties with their business-as-usual machine politics, and the fact that the community itself, the electorate, we citizens, are disengaging and looking other places for our own ways to deal with this. And we are simply not going to put up with it. Either it's going to be fixed or it's going to be broken, and I'm hoping it's going to be fixed. Part of this problem of legitimacy is, as I said, to do with the way in which political ideas are being expressed. You will have noticed as well as I do, and there's a slight shift back from this now, but it really doesn't matter what policy issue is being discussed in Australia today. Ultimately, it is only considered to be a good argument if it can be turned into some kind of expression of economic utility. Even as recently as 2 or 3 weeks ago, again, charities that had been established to try and work to end the scourge of child abuse felt it necessary to go to, I think, KPMG, one of the economic consulting firms, in order to have a document prepared to show that child abuse costs too much. Now, you've got to ask yourself, what kind of society is it that doesn't think that it's enough to say that child abuse is just terrible, that it's wrong, that it ought to be halted in its own terms? Why is it necessary to take that next step to say, and also, it costs too much? Well, it's a kind of society that has probably lost confidence in the language of ethics, thinks there's too much contestability about it, believes the myth that somehow or other economics will provide an entirely disinterested and neutral basis for making decisions. But this way in which so often the ethical dimension in politics is only given a passing nod, but in the end say, but you know, really what you need to know is that we've done the economic calculation. This, I think, rankles within the community. It means that there is nothing more than simple economic utility that is seen to define the policy-making process. And yet I do think that within Australia, despite our treatment of Indigenous people, despite the way that people like boat people are treated from time to time, despite all of that, there is an abiding sense in Australia that there needs to be fairness, an equitable society, that there is an ethical component of what we do. And I should say, in each of those cases, whether it's to do with budgets, the treatment of boat people, it's not a plain black and white question. There are ethical arguments to be made on both sides of that and ought to be respected and engaged with because, again, people of goodwill on both sides will have different principles which they bring to bear. But too often we don't have that discussion. It's ultimately reduced just to saying, well, it's a matter of simple economic utility. Now, please, I'm not saying we shouldn't think about economics. Of course we do. But if it's the knockdown argument for every policy case, it has an effect upon our view about the legitimacy of our system. So where does legitimacy actually come from? Well, partly it comes from the willingness to take the consequences when you have to make very difficult public decisions. There's a wonderful literature which every politician, certainly every member of the executive, should certainly read around an area in political philosophy called the problem of dirty hands. The problem of dirty hands is to do with what happens when you may be called upon to violate your own conscience for the sake of some public good. And one of the most powerful and perhaps provocative essays in this literature is by Michael Waltzer, who in an essay entitled The Problem of Dirty Hands says, what do we expect from a person who may have defined themselves for their whole life by their commitment to human rights, who then becomes an attorney general at a time when terrorists plant bombs in primary schools and they're ticking away, the authorities catch one person from this particular cell of terrorists, they come to the attorney general and say, attorney general, we believe that if we could torture this person, we might save some of the children in order to preserve their lives, but you must sign the paper. And Waltzer's provocative argument is firstly that the Attorney General should, for our own sakes, be a person who is so committed to human rights that if ever he was to sign that paper, he would be destroyed by this. He would never look at himself in the mirror again ever with any comfort. He would not sleep well at night. He would be destroyed. But he says he should be such a good commitment in his commitment to the public service that he should sign the paper. And thirdly, he says he should insist on being punished for doing so. Now, the exercise of government, I am sure, frequently involves circumstances where people are brought into positions where they have to do things which they would not themselves choose to do. And it may even include, from time to time, breaking promises which they find themselves unable to keep. The difference at the moment in terms of the legitimacy of our democracy is that this seems to occur without the third step that Walzer argues, without a recognition that this is a serious moral problem in a democracy and that it should be done, but I must be punished for doing so, so that it doesn't become the norm. And this, people would rightly say, is an impossible standard. How can I stand here and expect people who are citizens volunteering to serve in politics to do this? And I say I acknowledge it's a terrible cost, such as is also the case with ministerial responsibility, where people will remember Churchill's statement when Singapore fell. He said, "I did not know, I was not told, I should have asked." In Australia, you only hear, "I did not know, I was not told." These are burdens where you're going to be held to these almost impossible standards. But we have people who do this all the day. I have in the audience here one of our board members, General Jim Molan. He was in the Defence Force. Others may have done. We ask people to volunteer and go and put their lives on the line. No certainty that they will escape being wounded or killed when they serve. I don't think we should trouble ourselves too much if people want to volunteer in politics for a lesser hazard where they may be held to these impossible standards. But it's a standard we must insist on, because our constitution requires that ministers be responsible, and our democracy requires that if you have to break your word and thereby undo the fundamental grounds for consent, then you must insist that you pay the price for doing so. Now, repairing this at the moment requires a few things. The problem of what constitutes legitimacy is very difficult. And I'm going to rush now because I do want to leave some time for questions. Some of it comes from tradition. Some of it comes from the integrity of what you do, and I'm thinking of tradition with the Magna Carta sitting up there in its 800th anniversary this year, what that tells us about foundations of our system. Some of it comes from competence. And one of the really interesting things in the debate about trust in Australia is how the notion of trust is being redefined in the political arena. It happened some years ago under an earlier government where they said, you can trust us to fix the tax system or trust us to do something. The re-articulation of trust, not about integrity in terms of we will be what we say we do, but that we are competent, is been a very interesting feature to see in our democracy. And, of course, ultimately, the legitimacy of democracy comes from consent and the quality of the consent. So let me finish with a couple of things to do with possible areas of repair. Firstly, I think there's a need to have another discussion about the role of the Australian public service in this country. I described to you how the political gaze is necessarily partial in these times. Unfortunately, that partial gaze is progressively being introduced into the Australian public service, which must not have that partial gaze. The one bit of government which must see every single citizen, irrespective of where they live, what electorate they're in, whatever their condition, must be the Australian public service. And we need to go back to Hawke and that other Keating, Mike Keating, who sought to sort of realign the public service so that it served the interests of the government of the day, and have a really solid think about what arrangements we really should be making for the Australian public service. But the other thing I'm going to finish off with is an idea that what we should do is to look beyond politics of political parties, look beyond particular institutions, and instead try to develop a common ethical foundation for the way in which politics is practiced in this country. It should be freely chosen, it should be a voluntary commitment, but there should be something which, no matter what political party you stand for, no matter what your ideology, no matter whether you're interested in machines or otherwise, you should promise to the Australian people as the ethical foundation for your pursuit of politics. I wrote this some years ago, and it's called, for want of a better title, The Politician's Pledge. And I'm going to read it to you. It's the last thing I want to say, because what I hope to do is to encourage every candidate in the forthcoming New South Wales election and then subsequently in federal elections to commit to something like this. And you've seen some of the words in the flyer. As originally conceived, the practice of politics is intended to be a noble calling, the area within which a citizen might contribute to the establishment and maintenance of a good society. Yet without voluntary ethical restraint, the pursuit and exercise of power risks becoming personal, brutal, and self-serving, coarsening the polity, bringing public institutions into disrepute, and damaging the common weal. So, consistent with the highest ideals of our profession, I promise that in the pursuit of power, I will act in good conscience, enable informed decision-making by my fellow citizens, respect the intrinsic dignity of all, refrain from exploiting my rival's private failings for political gain, and act so as to merit the trust and respect of the community. And in the exercise of power, I will respect the trust placed in me by the people through the ballot box, abide by the letter and spirit of the Constitution, and uphold the rule of law, advance the public interest before any personal, sectarian, or partisan interest, hold myself accountable for conduct for which I am responsible, and exercise the privilege and discharge the duties of public office with dignity, care, and honour. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Longstaff, for that masterful analysis of some really, really thorny issues. Is anyone brave enough to ask a question? Yes, we've got...
You can ask me about anything too,
yes,
by the way.
There's a hand up there. As the microphone's coming towards you, let me throw my titles in for Barbarian versus Warrior.
Oh, yeah, what is it?
Politician versus Parliamentarian.
Okay. I'll try and see if we can find that out.
Yeah.
The difference between a politician and a parliamentarian is ethical restraint.
Ethical restraint, commitment to the ideals of the institution, the basis of what you're here, to the Constitution, mm-hmm. to service to the community.
Yep.
Anyway, question, sir.
Is that on?
Yep, it is, I think. Is it on?
Yeah. I think it is.
Okay.
You're on.
Oh, excellent. So you've put words to stuff that I've been thinking about for the last couple of years, and that was a really excellent speech, so I want to thank you for that. I have a lot of friends who are, like you spoke about, young people who are completely disengaged. And we can see that, I guess, from looking at the audience today. There's not a lot of young faces, unfortunately. And I think that young people have a really good sense of ethics and ethical foundations, but I'm concerned, as you are, that they're completely disconnected from the political system. I wondered if you had any thoughts on how young people and their good sense of ethics can be, I guess, reconnected back to the political system so that we can help bring this common ethical foundation that you're talking about.
Well, thank you for that. And I agree with the first point you make, very strongly agree that your generation, other younger people, are brimful with idealism. But often what they're lacking is hope that it's possible to actually make a difference. And so the level of engagement which flows from that is they tend to work on things which they can actually control themselves in their own friendship groups, smaller community things, or sometimes in an online way where there's a dissipated influence. And I see this as partly a product of the baby boomers too often telling younger people to be realistic. I hate being realistic. I'm a pragmatic idealist. triumph of optimism over experience. But anyway, I think you can be pragmatic and you can be idealistic. And so part of what we need to do is, I think, to convince people too that the better world that we might hope to make as citizens doesn't always require grand gestures. More often than not, in fact, it's just falling just slightly the right side of each question and slowly the accumulation of those smaller decisions just the right side begin to affect change. But to engage in politics, I think, is going to require a new model of citizen engagement. And it's starting to happen. I was invited to northeast Victoria late last year, a rural community, and I went to Swan Hill in Yackandandah, and over 2 days, about 300 people, ranging from 12 years of age through to 80 or something like that, came off their farms, out of their shops to talk about politics, to talk about their democracy, not politics, to talk about democracy. And I believe that there is a capacity to provide a different scale of engagement, which young people are just as likely to plug into, because it provides a chance to do something which doesn't have to be huge but is big enough to make a difference. And so I wonder, partly I wonder, because there were people there, for example, the Northern Rivers of New South Wales who've invited me up, and Tony Windsor was the other person who was there, to talk about democracy. And I suspect that there may be small-scale community engagement which is going to be attractive, and then for people to become involved in practical ways which they can afford with the time and resources they have.
We've got two over here. Sir, I think you are marginally ahead, closer to the front. And then we'll go to you, sir, and that might be it. We'll see.
As a woman.
As a long-term resident of the ACT, I've constantly felt unrepresented. When I arrived in the ACT, we had one federal member, Jim Fraser. If we're talking about a democracy, how can we better change our model to remove some of the skews that are in our electorates, the way they're set up, and the almost fundamental intent by certain political parties to continue to maintain the lack of representation in our federal parliament of a fairly vibrant, well-resourced, well-educated society like we have in Canberra.
There's obviously a technical aspect to how you do that, which I don't know the answer to, but I think the thing that I take from your question is this very interesting idea that somehow the electorate always gets it wrong when it puts into, say, the Senate a mixture of people.
And
so you see discussion now about political parties, you know, the big ones, Liberal and Labor, but how they could arrange the electoral system so as to have fewer minor parties actually elected to Parliament. Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with our system as it is, actually. I mean, if we wanted as a people to elect...
There's got to be something wrong if there's manipulation like
happening. Yeah, but the actual system allows us at the moment, if we wanted to elect all of one party and none of another or whatever. It's to do with, as I think you're putting your finger on, the attempt within those who can, by those who control it, to tinker with it to bring about the result that they would like to have, rather than one that authentically represents the views of the public, as if the public is constantly getting it wrong. And I think if you keep doing that, that's going to be another issue that begins to call into question the legitimacy of the system. Because if every response from those who've got power is to change the system so they can keep power, eventually the public, which is... Yeah, but I think the consequence of not fixing the problem which you put your finger on is potentially that it delegitimises that. It looks like it's been set up for everybody, and that's one of the things we have to look at. But you can only answer that question if you go back to the one I tried to pose, is understand the proper purpose of the institutions and particularly what democracy actually is. I wish I had a technical answer, but I don't.
We can't have a dialogue. Yeah. It's very hard to see. The man in the blue check shirt, and then we'll have time for just one more, I think.
Thank you very much for a very stimulating presentation. In terms of the caps on financial contributions, would you like to comment in the context of your ethical analysis, please?
I am an advocate of the public funding of elections, and I would have a different model than exists at the moment, in which there is a public pool administered by someone like the Australian Electoral Commission to which any citizen may make a donation, and with a capped amount which can be then specified for use of a particular party of their name. And the reason I say that, and that's, I'm not going to be able to answer your question properly now because it's a very complicated, long, lengthy answer I'd have to give to you, but I'm happy to share some information later if that would be helpful. But I think that too often I see people arguing in the favour of wanting to support democracy when in fact what they want to do is support a partial interest, and I think there are better ways to put that in place. So I'm sorry it's an inadequate answer, but what you ask is a very complex answer.
Our last question will go back to this side, and then we will have had a perfect balance between left and right.
as is your want, Rosemary.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
You had a lot of criticism from the major parties, and I think it was quite justified. But I think that you sort of get to that threshold where you lose all patience and become a very volatile electorate where there is no outlet for legitimacy. I was wondering what you thought about the minor parties and what they've done in recent times. And you look at the Democrats, and they said they would keep the bastards honest, but often they would then get to an election result and then not allow the party that won to enact their policies and would keep them dishonest. You've got the Greens at the moment refusing to support indexation of petrol, but that's been their policy forever and a day. So I think that's when the electorate gets very volatile and frustrated, where even the minor parties are acting in a hypocritical fashion.
Thank you for that. I tried not to speak just about the major parties or an individual. So it's my fault for not being clearer. The comments I was making applied to the political class and all parties. I think every one of them has played some role, as I say, tipping a thimble at a time into the situation in which we find ourselves. It's to do partly with the game of politics. Sometimes it is based on a principled position. Other times it's just political calculation around that. I think that playing of the game, as if it's all understood within the limited rules that take place, say, here in the Senate and in the House of Reps, it doesn't. This bleeds out into the public, and hence the effects upon the community at large. I mean, I believe there is a different kind of politics that can emerge, which would be far better at serving the national interest and which would perhaps, you know, start to empty, bail out some of this sludge, but it's going to be very difficult. But it's only going to happen if politicians in every single party believe that they have a public duty to our democracy and the quality of our polity that comes before the duty they have to their party. That all of them have got to say, we see what's happening here now, we have got to protect our democracy, and that has a prior claim upon us.
Well, on that note, I think, sadly, I have to tell you that our time is up, but thank you for terrific questions, thank you for participation, but most of all, I'd like you to join me in thanking Dr. Longstaff for a wonderful lecture.